Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is John Sowers. He is a public speaker, developer, and entrepreneur. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited to dive in and talk about a whole bunch of different topics with you today. But let's get started right at the beginning and let's learn a little bit more about you and what you do. You wear many hats, as I said, public speaker, you're a software developer, and entrepreneur as well. So why don't you go ahead and briefly tell us a little bit about those roles and also what you're currently working on right now that you're most excited about.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess I'll go chronologically and start with developer. That's something I started doing back in high school in the late 80s. And so I've been doing that professionally since 95. So I think that's, 22 years or something. Also done a lot of graphic design early on in my career. I actually started developing on back in the age of interactive CD-ROMs, if that gives you an idea of how old that is. And so, yeah, I've been doing that for quite a long time and really enjoyed it. Like once I discovered development, I sort of just realized like how much I did it. And I was sort of frequently doing it in my free time, even when I had a job where I was doing it all day. Mm-hmm. And the entrepreneur part of me, my sort of life is has been going for quite a long time, too. I actually started in the late 90s, once I was sort of well into web development, I realized that like I could build websites, I could run businesses. And so I did some like online CD sales in the late 90s and a bunch of other things like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's always been a thread in my career. So I've been sort of moving in and out of either working for someone else or working on projects of my own. Mm-hmm. And most recently, I've been the co-founder and CTO of a company called Data Simply that takes SEC filing data that companies are required to file with any public company is required to file these documents. And we sort of mine that data for the concepts of things they're talking about so we can figure out what their environmental, social, and governance issues are. So we can highlight companies that are doing particularly well or particularly bad and on those axes. Mm-hmm. Got it. And then I guess public speaker is the most recent thing I started. Mm-hmm. Let's see, about year and a half, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Basically it was prompted by having an idea that was so good I couldn't not talk about it to people. and so it was really motivated me to face that fear of being in front of people and just talking about the things that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, and that's actually what I'd like to talk a little bit more about, John, is the topic of your public speaking. It's essentially talking about emotions. And I love emotions and talking about emotions and learning about emotions for a variety of reasons. And you use the metaphor of an API to talk about emotions, which is just immediately fascinating to me. And so let's definitely get into that so that folks can learn, you know, your approach, your kind of tech-based approach, tech-friendly approach to thinking about emotions. But first, let's just sort of address the elephant in the room that I think maybe at least some of the listeners may be wondering about, which is essentially, why talk about emotions at all? Like, it's just, they're just touchy-feely, right? Why do we even have to bother with it? So what I'm curious about is what led you down the path of learning about emotions and talking about the importance of emotions, and specifically within tech?
Yeah, so it's a kind of interesting story. So back when I was living in Florida, this was back in the late 2000s, I went to a workshop called Purpose, Passion, Peace. And the idea behind the workshop is that it creates this incredibly safe environment and facilitates like getting in touch with, you know, basically the emotions that you've been holding on to your whole life. I mean, they could be like current ones, but most often it's things that come from long ago in your past that you've never dealt with. And that process was so transformative to me. I went to the first weekend sort of as a participant, but then it's organized around having people who've been through it before come back and assist the other people that are going through it for the first time. So there's people that know what you've been going through to sort of help out and provide support. And so I went and did that like every time for, I did maybe 10 or 15 of them over the next couple of years, because it was like even that process was so helpful to me, not only helping me learn how emotions worked in myself, but also seeing them work the same way in other people and realizing that my experience with them can help those other people work through their experiences as they're going through them. So that was incredibly helpful to me. It really did change my life, because I, up to that point, and I talk about this in my talk, up to that point, I was really not in touch with my emotions, and I wasn't handling them well, and I wasn't didn't know what to do with any of them, right? Like there's no and sort of this is another part of my talk is we talk, I mentioned like how we get no real training in what you're supposed to do with emotions, like what are healthy ways of handling them. Like then that's what this workshop gave me. It's like, oh, now I know I have all these things I can do that will help me process and handle things rather than just trying to pretend they don't exist and then dealing with the inevitable consequences.
And I definitely encourage folks to check out that talk. What's the best way for people to find it? How can they find it online?
Go to emotionalapi.com. There's a video hosted there, and that will have all the information about like what I'm talking about, what the talks are, the various places I've given the talk, and how to invite me to give the talks elsewhere.
That's awesome. And so when you think back to the Purpose, Passion, Peace workshop, you said that it was transformative, and I can relate to that. I've gone through similar kinds of transformative workshops experiences in my career. So when you look back on that, was it like one thing that was like a oh wow, like oh shit moment, or was it like a combination of wow, I never really looked at it this way, that really like made the difference for you, in terms of making a difference in your life and the way that you approached your emotions?
I think it's much more like the entirety of the experience, because a big part of it was just the raw experience of expressing, feelings that I'd been holding on to for 20, 30 years. And just like that experience doesn't translate into words in any way. And so, after that experience, through the rest of the work I did there, I sort of learned to have words for it and to help sort of understand it at a little bit more of an intellectual level, and also to understand how to get past that intellectual level into the feeling level so that you can do that feeling work, in the feeling rather than trying to think about the feeling, which just sort of breaks it down and it doesn't work very well.
You actually made a bunch of wonderful points there, about expressing those feelings, right, and having the words for them. But then there's also that separate piece of it is there's just like the feeling experience of it, as opposed to the thinking experience of it. So when you say having words for emotions, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, for me, it's always been very hard to put words to them. Like, even if I had some sort of vague concept of what they were, like describing the what was causing it, or like even like nuances of what the feeling was, is very difficult. And part of that process is worrying about picking the wrong word. Like, I'm always like, I don't want to say it wrong. I want to say the right thing perfectly. And learning to get rid of that editing so that I can just put lots of words out there, and then a big pile of words will describe the thing. So it doesn't have to be like well-edited literature that I'm speaking.
I've found in my interactions with folks who are developers and who have been developers for a number of years, the word that often comes to mind when I try to put my finger on what is it, what is it that's different about interacting with them, they're very pedantic, very specific, because I mean that's what you have to do, right, when you're coding. I mean, I know enough about code to talk about it, but I'm definitely not a coder or a developer. I can look at it and maybe guess what you're trying to do. But I get how, thinking so specifically and thinking so structurally, like it really matters. Like what variable are we talking about? what do we, what action are we calling or whatever it is. It really matters to say whether this is, V1 or V2 or whatever. But then, and so that's what I can see as a barrier to talking about these touchy-feely things like emotions, where, you know what, it really doesn't matter what you call it. It's about your own experience of it. And it's kind of getting over that. That's a big piece of it, I think, for some people.
Yeah, for sure. And that was part of what motivated me to start talking about this, was that like I felt like it was so important to me, and I also have been a developer for so long, that I feel like I understand, I can speak the language. And so I spent a year or two just sort of thinking about what could I do in this area. And one night it just sort of hit me like a lightning bolt that I could use this API metaphor. And I just sat down and wrote like 5 or 6 pages of just brain dump on like how all the different interactions and ways I could use this metaphor to describe it. And so I felt like having this sort of very well understood metaphor that I could say, hey, think about an API, here's endpoints, here's things you can call, and here's how responses work. Like that makes it a very, that keeps it in the intellectual realm. It keeps it sort of safe and understandable, but gives a framework for jumping off into those deeper, squidgier, less understandable areas.
And you talk about this in your talk, but if you want to just give a brief overview of what do you mean by emotional API?
Yeah, so basically the idea is, if you think about how feelings work and you model that as an API, you think about you have an endpoint like slash V1 slash feeling slash anger, V1 slash feeling slash sadness, whatever. You've got a series of those, and those are sort of the core sort of biological hardwired endpoints that you get. And then I sort of build on top of that, saying that, like those are the sort of the raw things that we have as humans. But then as we grow up, we add more and more things that call those endpoints. So they're basically like methods, like other API endpoints that run methods that call those core endpoints. So for example, something tragic happens to you, that can create a new endpoint that creates the sadness and confusion and anger and basically, all the sort of feelings that get mixed up together, all calling that core endpoint. And you can think about like these sort of important events happening to you as, call, like making a call to that endpoint. And then once that endpoint's created, it can be called by anybody. Like these are public endpoints. It's a public API. So like you can't not have certain endpoints called. So if you've got them there, if you've got that method that makes you respond with a mixture of sadness and irritation and depression when certain things happen, that's always going to happen when those things happen, unless you take that API endpoint method and refactor it, which is basically the process of doing this emotional work where you clear out the emotional associations, the old stored feelings that you have, so that it basically, to stick with the metaphor, it sends less traffic to that core API. It causes fewer of those strong primal central emotions.
Got it. Got it. And like I said, I know enough about coding and programming to follow this at least a theoretical level. But for folks who are listening who may not know anything at all about programming, let's back up a few steps. So API, explain what that is in layman's terms.
Sure. It's basically a standard contract slash protocol that two systems use to talk to each other, in the broadest sense. Like the systems could be two different companies on the internet, Snapchat and Facebook, or it could be two components within your local computer, like the file system and a running process of a database or something. It goes at many, many different levels. But the
Got
basic
it.
idea is, it's an agreed upon sort of syntax for talking to one another. If you send me this, I will send you that. If you send me this, I will send you that.
Got it. And API stands for Application Processing Interface, Programming Interface.
Programming interface.
Got it. Okay. And that's actually really helpful because I think a lot of people, when they hear API, if you know anything about tech, it's sort of like, I don't know, I kind of assume, I didn't realize it was so general. I thought it had like a very, very like specific use. It's like, oh, I need the API key. Like that's where I've been, like where I've encountered it. Like I need to send them this software, the API key for this other software. So I thought it was like that would be a very specific use case for it, but it sounds like it's much more general than that.
Yes, yeah.
And so when we're talking about the two systems with regards to emotions, how do you make that parallel? So like, what are the two systems? Is it like the emotional
Right.
system in your brain, or is that kind of how you think about it?
Well, I think of it more like just the self. Like you've got yourself that has this the API, and the other end of it, the other API is like the world, like other people. It could be events, it could be TV programs, whatever, things that come to you, and that they make those API calls, and then you have an emotional response as part of that.
I love this because this isn't only applicable to emotions, it's applicable to the self in general, thoughts, reactions, identity, personality even, right?
Yeah,
Because it's
for
like
sure.
if it's our interaction with the world, right? And it's
Yeah.
okay if this happens, then I do this, then I think that, then I feel that. That it's a great way of thinking about it.
Yeah, it could be very well used as a metaphor to look at other things like if you've got intrusive thoughts, or if you have, cognitive disorders, or if you have like any sort of thing like that. And again, even up to the level of personality, like, you it's incredibly reductive, but I'm sure there's some people tempted to think about like if the personality is actually encompassed by the series of API inputs and outputs, sort of a very me mechanistic model. I mean, I don't, that's not something I subscribe to, but I can see that someone would go that far with it.
Potentially, right? I mean, I think the personality one might get a little bit dicey just depending on what your beliefs are about personality and, sort
Yeah.
of what theories that you buy into, what research you buy into, what, and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I love just the idea of thinking it's like it's the self is one system and the world is another system, and how do we interact with that world? Yeah. And so you mentioned another thing a little bit earlier, John, that I wanted to circle back to when you were kind of talking about, the purpose, passion, peace, experience, and about having words to describe things, but that also it's like it's this thinking versus feeling dichotomy, and that actually sometimes we need to get the thinking out of the way. It's more about the feeling of it. And that's really what the core of emotions are. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's a topic that fascinates me as well.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, one of the things I do in the talk is I start with looking at the words for things, because I think having those intellectual handles for people can be really helpful as sort of as a way of sort of having a little bit more knowledge of the territory before you sort of go into the deep end of not having the structure. So I do some work about like how to find good words for things, and ways of learning to communicate emotions through words. But then once you get to the point of actually just going into the feeling, that's a whole different process, because you have to basically turn off a large part of your brain that wants to process and understand and make connections and do relations, when really all you need to do is just have a feeling and let it happen. And so that was the next part of my talk is, techniques that you can use to just short circuit that process and get into a feeling. And so one of the techniques that's, I think, easiest to do alone is and I talk about, and there's a whole section on this in the talk, of is trying to get in touch with anger. So a lot of people, that's the easiest feeling to get in touch with, because it's the most acceptable in society, especially for men. It's you're most allowed to have that feeling, and so it's easiest to get in touch with that and start letting it go. Although I think most people are like me, in that they're actually afraid of their anger. Like they feel like it's going to be too destructive or too problematic. And so you've got now these two emotions feeding into each other, which makes the whole thing even more complicated. So
Fear
part
and
of,
anger. Yep.
yeah. So part of getting into that anger feeling and letting it go, help you have to get past the fear. And then once the anger is gone, then the fear can go away, because you've been to the anger and realized it didn't cause any problems.
And one of the things that you talk about in the talk is essentially kind of having, the equivalent of like screaming into a pillow kind of thing, having your own kind of rituals, just sort of like let it go, So I think that can be a really helpful way of that kind of getting in touch with that emotion, right? And like, okay, that's okay to feel what it's okay to feel this, that this is why. And let me just vent a little bit. Let me just go into a room and scream and then get over it. I think what I find interesting about this is while I find that helpful for me, like personally, sometimes what I find is that it can, depending on what I'm reacting to and what kind of mood I'm in and how I'm feeling in general, that could actually very easily go into like a negative death spiral thing where it's like I just kind of lose control and then it's like an hour before I'm my normal self again. And so I think that's kind of where we have to be careful with that piece of it is just kind of knowing yourself, you know, how much control do you have over, you know, these feelings and how you're going to react to them. And that perhaps sometimes the best way to deal with anger, like for myself, what I've found is you just kind of acknowledge it. Like, okay, I'm feeling that anger bubble up a little bit. Okay, anger. Okay, this is cool. Why are you there? It means I'm alive. Okay, and it means I care about whatever just happened. And how do I deal with this? As opposed to letting it go to sort of that negative death spiral place. So have you experienced this, or do you have any thoughts on sort of this kind of really letting it go and going into this sort of rage party versus kind of just, okay, it's there, and then moving on?
Well, certainly the acknowledgement is the first step in all of this work is saying, yes, this is what is happening to me. This is what I am currently feeling. And it's a great first step because a lot of people aren't there yet. So even getting there can be really helpful just by acknowledging what's going on. And I think as far as like when you get into that deep expression, I think that's one of the reasons P3 is structured the way it is that you've got a bunch of people in the room who are all really experienced with being in this state. So that when you do it, the whole team is around you, helping you do it and helping you manage what happens.
Got it.
So you've got tons of support to work through that process so that you can come out of it and then process what you just went through and integrate it and understand it without just sort of being like, well, what the hell just happened to me?
Yep. I could totally see how that support is important, and that's kind of how you learned how to do it then, and why you know you can do that now, because you can kind of go back to that time when you were in that extremely safe place and there were people surrounding you who really cared about you.
Yeah, and that's definitely the key is like for me, like I talk about doing it on your own because it's something I do now because I have done it in that other environment. And some people doing it in that environment is, or at least they think it's more difficult because there are other people around that they don't know. And like, how could you possibly have a feeling like that with people you don't know? But that's one of the remarkable things about the workshop is what an incredibly safe space it creates so that you feel like you can do that. So that's definitely a big part of it.
Got it. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. Let's talk about some of the benefits, or at least one specific benefit that I'm interested in of basically, you know, getting in touch with our emotions, or as you would frame it within the API metaphor, refactoring those emotions with regards to our careers. So you talk about how refactoring our emotional APIs can really improve the arcs of our careers. So let's talk a little bit about that. So first, what do you mean by that to start with?
So I mean that on sort of several different levels, but the sort of the core of it that sort of feeds into these other levels is that when you do this work yourself, you gain more control of yourself. You gain more understanding of yourself. Like if you've got lots of long buried emotions, you've got all these endpoints out there that things can call that will cause you to react in ways you probably don't want to react when situations occur. Like I had an example in my talk about because my father died early and because of the way he died, I felt like I didn't have a strong paternal influence. I didn't have that approval. When I had male bosses later on in my career, I was always striving for their approval. And so when things went wrong, the emotions I felt, like I release a bug to production, oh my God, it's not that big a deal. But for me, it felt like, I've just pissed off daddy and, the world is going to end. And so, like, my emotional reaction to that work experience was from when I was five, but it was happening right then and there in my office. And so, being able to do the work and remove those endpoints so that when things like that happen now, I don't have that same emotional reaction. I can handle it with, like, okay, well, let's just fix the bug. That allows me to be a much better developer, right? Because I'm not sort of stuck in this spiral of, oh my God, what's going on? So, like, that's the sort of core example of, like, I think how it affects your career. Just by having more control of your emotions, being more yourself, reacting to things the way you want to react to them. And so, and that flows directly into how you interact with your team members. Like, if you have lots of these API endpoints and things are getting triggered all the time, they can turn you into kind of an ass, and it can make it less, much less easy to work with your team if you're having weird reactions to things that they don't really understand. And additionally, the work also gives you a lot of empathy for other people. So you understand, you can see when they're having weird emotional reactions and have some understanding of what that might be. So you are able to handle that situation better from your side.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about the empathy piece of it, and how it can increase social interactions, not only from like from our end of it, like so like from my individual reactions and having control over them, but also when I see somebody else saying something, do something that may potentially piss me off, make me sad, make me worried, make me fearful, that because I understand the way that emotions work a little bit more, that I can actually have more empathy for that person and not be as judgmental about what they're going through, even if it's something, even if they call me a jerk. I'm like, okay, I get it. This person might be suffering, and that's why they called me a jerk. And it makes it much easier to look at it almost objectively from that perspective.
Yeah, and so that's the sort of individual contributor level. I think the stakes go up when you become a manager because you're dealing with a team. You're responsible for the social and emotional cohesion of the team, and so the need to have these skills and the self-understanding, so you know how you're reacting to things, and then also having that empathy for each of your team members, so that you can grok what their emotional states are going through and help them work on what they need to work on. That's sort of the next level up. And then beyond that, even as an entrepreneur, even as a solopreneur, if you're just working for yourself, having an understanding of your own emotional reactions is critical for business. Like, if you realize that there are certain business interactions that you're afraid of, that you're avoiding, but that are necessary for your business to proceed, like being able to get that under control and go through that and do those things without the fear is incredibly important.
All really, really great points. I'm curious, John, about your habits and or rituals, if you have any. Whether they're, people call them different things, mindset rituals. They may include things like meditation or journaling or, going for a walk every day or every evening, just to sort of, make sure that we're keeping in check with what's going on, and that we're sort of reminding ourselves about our wins. And some people do things like gratitude journals and stuff like that. So I'm curious, because this is an area that you're clearly very passionate about and it's important to you and in your life, do you have any daily or ish habits or rituals that you find really super important, essential, maybe even to your life?
Well, definitely meditation is a huge piece. Has had a huge impact on my life, just as far as having additional insight into my own mind and into, like, ways that I can very quickly switch into the relaxation response, and so I can handle tense situations a little bit better. Gratitude journaling in general, and specifically about gratitude, is also incredibly important. It's something I do almost every day, because I find it's, I mean, there's actually a lot of research about how effective it is at improving your mental state and emotional state. So that's something I do quite a bit. I think diet is actually a huge impact on your emotional state. Like, think about when you get hangry, like you're not a nice person. And that's because your blood sugar is low, and like managing that biological input into your emotion is like this whole other massive topic that I haven't even gotten into
I love thinking about that it that way, managing the biological inputs of your emotions. That's really deep. I love that. I love that.
yet.
And that's why things like diet and exercise, it's not just, oh, because my doctor told me to do it. Like these things have a real profound effect on the way that we act and think and feel.
Yeah, I mean, you usually think about exercise in the context of, like physical fitness, but it's just as much about mental fitness. There's so much research that points to its effect on depression and anxiety and other things like that, other mental situations that, and even clearing out emotions. Like, that's a slide I have in my talk that, physical activity can be one of the ways that help you express the feeling. So even if you're exercising and you're also, at the same time, working through a feeling, that can be a good way to do it, because feelings at their base start in your physical body. Like, they're not just a mental thing that doesn't really exist in the world. They're a state in your body, and they have to move out of your body in some physical way.
Let's talk about meditation just for a little bit more, kind of around the how of the meditation. And if people are listening and want to start meditating and they're just aren't sure how, I'm kind of on a personal quest to get more people meditating. So I take any chance I get to talk with people who I know are successful and say, oh yeah, absolutely, meditation is essential to me. So how do you meditate? Do you use an app? Is it something else? Maybe that it'll resonate with someone and get them started.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, currently I'm using a program called Centerpoint, which is a basically specially encoded audio that uses different brainwave, different sound frequencies to alter the frequency of your brainwaves to get you into certain altered states. And there are any number of different products out there that use the same technique, and they're all, I sort of think of it almost like training wheels, like, because like straight ahead, like Zen meditation, where you're just sitting and sort of watching your mind go by, is incredibly difficult. It takes a long time to master, and it's very difficult at first because you feel like you're failing constantly. And so I don't know that that's the best place to start meditating, because it's so difficult at the beginning. So I think these sort of audio assistants can be great, because they give you sort of training wheels to get into it, so you know what it feels like, so that you can then start maybe doing it without the audio if you decide to. But you now know what it feels like, you know what that looks like, you know how to get into the state, and so it becomes easier without those training wheels.
So this is is it an app or is it a program? Is it like iPhone, Android, that kind of thing, or is it something
It's
else?
a downloadable audio.
Awesome. And what's it called again? Just one more time.
Centerpoint with an E at the end.
Got it. Cool. And so it's essentially it's audio, and you just kind of you put it on your phone, you put the phone next to you on a table, you sit comfortably, and you listen to the audio.
Yeah, headphones are fairly important, because the specific frequencies go in specific ears, which is part of how the technology works.
That's cool.
But yeah, that's basically how it works. It's like you just listen to the sound of rain, and the sound does the work.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very cool. I think I might want to try that. I myself, I use Headspace, so it's a meditation app, but it's guided, right? So it's very similar. There's apps for Android, iPhone, et cetera. And you just listen. There's a guy, a very peaceful voice sounding Australian guy, I believe, who's basically, guiding you through the meditation. And they really do take it step by step. I mean, definitely to your point where that kind of meditation, especially if it's just, sitting with your thoughts with no guidance, is extremely, extremely hard. I've been meditating for probably about a year now. So I'm still new at it, depending on how you want to gauge it. But there are times like when I'm doing the meditation, like with Headspace, where they spread out the silences in between. Like in the very beginning, it's a lot of guidance, right? But then they'll start spreading out the silences, and then it's like, oh wow, I'm doing it wrong, or oh, my mind is wandering. And it's like just kind of learning, actually, you know, you're not doing it wrong. That's actually what's exactly supposed to happen, and is training your brain to go back to that state of focus, or whatever it is that you're supposed to be focused on. So
yeah, and cool. to start gaining that awareness of like thoughts going by. And then like, and I think the first big insight I think you often get with meditation is starting to realize, once you just watch thoughts go by, that there's something watching those thoughts go by, and that like you and your thoughts are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's huge. That's really huge. We are not our thoughts. We are not our feelings. And that's a really hard one to grasp, I think. That's taken me a while. It's been like multiple times of thinking about it, feeling it, you know, and experiencing. It's like, that's what that is, right? But I think that's a key, that's like a key distinction. That's a key like mindset shift, that if, you know, if someone can make that shift, you just have so much more control over your life. It's so much more happiness, sure. I think, too, and whatever it is you want to bring to your life.
Yeah, definitely. And going back to the guided meditations, like those, again, are also great sort of ways to get into it that are a lot easier, because you've got sort of help sort of bringing you along the process. Mm-hmm. There's an app called Buddhify that I like quite a bit mm-hmm. for that. And there's also another audio product called Paraliminals that does some really interesting stuff with neurolinguistic programming, and the way that like different words being spoken in different ears to sort of short circuit your thinking mind mm-hmm. so they go straight into your subconscious.
Cool. Cool. Awesome. Awesome. Sounds like some great stuff to check out for, especially for beginners too, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. All right, John. So the last question that I have for you is a question that I ask everyone. And that question is everyone who's on this podcast anyway, which is, what's the biggest people-related challenge in your job? And given that you wear many hats, how about we change that to in your career? Yeah. So what's the biggest people-related challenge in your career?
I love that question. And it's actually something I've been thinking about for a while since I started listening to your podcast, because I was like, how do I answer that question? and really the answer is me. Like, I'm my biggest people challenge. Like, I'm my biggest project. It's something I'm working on all the time. Something I'm always getting better at least I hope. But like learning like how I work, how to manage the way I react to certain things, how to like set up habits in my life. Like there's so much in there, and it takes so much work to get myself, you know, set up and working correctly, is the way I think about it. That, you know, it's a continuous process. I'll never be done with it. Yeah. And that's actually a point I talk about at the end of my talk, where I say, you know, even if you start down this path of working through your emotions, you're never done. Like, you're never at the end of your emotions and you're completely like sort of floating free in the universe and don't have any emotional reactions to things. That doesn't happen. Like, it's just the process of getting better at it over the course of your lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely a journey. And I love there's a tendency sometimes for when we think, oh, you know, what's going wrong in my life, and what are the challenges that I face, that, and look, and this is a totally human thing to do, is to think about other people's effect on that. It can almost move into blaming, you know, sort of blaming other people, mm-hmm. blaming the system, whatever system that might be. And is it as hard as it might be to accept, it could be a really tough pill to swallow, that no, actually it's me. You know, if you're not getting where you want in your life, take a look in the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. And that while that can be really hard, it's also extremely empowering, that wow, that's what I have control over. So I love mm-hmm. that for that reason.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that goes back to the sort of core, like unspoken idea that underlies most of what I'm talking about, which is that starting your work on yourself is how you fix pretty much anything, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a career, whether it's just the way you interact with your teammates or your friends. Like, you can learn things about interpersonal communication, and you can study frameworks, and there's lots of things you can do about that, but you have to start like at the source and look at what you're putting out there in order to take control over like the origins of everything else that happens to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you think about this me project, this becoming the best version of myself project, and it absolutely is a challenge, what would you say that you've learned that has helped you to attack that challenge a little bit more effectively?
Well, I think I'm pretty lucky in that I think I've always had a growth mindset. So from the start, I know that I can change, that I can get better, that I'm not stuck with that sort of Carol Dweck, like I'm smart and therefore, or I am shy and therefore, or whatever. So I'm always looking at things that I can change and improve and optimize. I mean, I do that in other parts of my, like in things that aren't me as well, but I think applying it to the self is probably the most important.
So applying this sort of the growth mindset
Yeah.
that's really been the most helpful to you. So what do you mean by growth mindset? Basically that, you know, that we have control and that we have control over our own learning and growth, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that sort of personal traits are not fixed, right? Like you can get into like when I was young, I was very, very shy. Like and I thought of myself as a shy person until a decade ago. And now, you know, I'm getting up on stage and talking to audiences of hundreds and being interviewed on podcasts and things like that. And like it feels very antithetical to the old concept of me, but because I don't feel like that's written in stone, I can change it.
And so, yeah, this kind of brings us kind of full circle in terms of something that you mentioned at the beginning, John, was basically the public speaking, that this is something that is relatively recent, that you started about 2 years ago. And that clearly this is part of your me project. This is about kind of pushing the boundaries of your comfort zone and, you know, that this quote unquote shy person can absolutely, you know, go out there and do public speaking, for example. So if what advice would you have to anyone, especially the more introverted among us, the more quote unquote shy among us that want to get started in public speaking, what advice would you have for them to really just, you know, do it, take action and do it?
I mean, I think partly it's a matter of baby steps. Like there are, you know, small ways that you can start doing it just by like if you're on a small team making a presentation to the other four people that you work with about some small, like a 15-minute, like you can start really small, just about something you've learned that's useful to you, to them professionally. You can also do like training things like Toastmasters because having expert guidance and practice is sort of a huge part of it also. I didn't do that, but I've heard great stories about the things you can learn from having that experience. As far as I think one of the things to realize is there's actually now a lot of great information out there about how to become a public speaker. I know Laura Hogan has a book, Public Speaking Demystified, and there are a couple others that go through you know, some of those early steps and like how do you get started and some of those things. I think one thing that helped me a great deal was just following a number of speakers really on Twitter, and watching them talk about their speaking process. So you see someone go up there and they're incredibly poised and articulate, and you think, wow, that was an amazing speech. And then you see on Twitter they posted at 2 a.m. the morning before. They're like, I can't get to sleep. I'm puking in the bathroom. I'm so nervous about tomorrow. Like, and then you're like, oh, so even like I can still feel this way and still perform that way, and so it's okay. Like I'm not the only one that feels this way. Like that's incredibly helpful.
Just sort of being aware of how you feel, you know, what emotions you might feel, whether it's, you know, an hour before, 10 minutes before, right when you get up on stage, when it's done. Like for me, like I know no matter what, I've done it hundreds of times, right? But no matter what, whatever size of the audience, whether it's like five people who I know really well, or if it's like 100 people, I always get nervous right before. But then, like for me, it's as soon as I step up on that stage and start my thing, especially if I've done a bunch of practicing, even if I haven't though, it's like it all goes away. And it's like this is just about me sharing something with the world, and it's about them. And like I want to show up even better because I want them to learn. And so I think that can help too, is like that sort of other sort of orientation that like, this isn't about you. They want to learn something, or they want to laugh, or they want to cry, or whatever it is. Like if you focus on it that way, I think that can kind of tamp the nervousness down a little bit. But yeah, I think, yeah. I don't know. I think everybody gets nervous. I don't think I've ever heard anybody I don't get nervous at all when I'm talking in front of 1,000 people. Like, are you alive?
Well, yeah. The other bit of advice I always give is like that the audience wants you to succeed. Like even if you mess up a little bit, they're going to forget that immediately because they want to remember all the good things about your talk. Like they're not there with Rotten Tomatoes waiting for you to slip up. Like
that's right.
They have a better experience if it all goes well, and if you just sort of jump over a flub and keep going, than if you freeze up or, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
And you bring out a great point, is that again, it goes back to that same knowledge of your own emotional responses and knowing good ways to handle that. So if you know that an hour before you need this sort of help and preparation, if you need silence and quiet, or if you need to be talking to friends and distracting yourself, or if you're going to be this nervous, do you need that? Should you eat beforehand or not beforehand because your stomach gets all rumbly, or like going through that process and learning those things is incredibly important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, John. So I think we're just about up on time. We've covered a bunch of topics, and it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been a great conversation.
Okay, great. Thanks.